Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of Aquadocs, the podcast that keeps you up to date on all things aquatic medicine. I'm your host, Michelle Greenfield. This week, I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Bill Van Bonn, the former Vice President for Animal Health and Welfare at Shedd Aquarium. On this episode, we're going to talk about Dr. Van Bonn's microbiome study, and a special congratulations to Dr. Van Bonn, who recently retired from a long tenure in the aquatic veterinary field. We recorded this episode a few months prior to his retirement. So without further ado, welcome to Aquadocs, Dr. Van Bonn.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I am super excited to talk about some of your current work and your previous work on this episode today. But before we get into that, can you share a story with our listeners that helped shape where you are today as an aquatic veterinarian?
So I graduated from veterinary school quite a while ago, and there was not really a zoo or aquarium career pathway at that point. And I originally aspired to be an equine surgeon. And I did that for a couple of years after veterinary school, but life has a way of throwing things at you. And I found out after a few years, I wasn't sure I wanted to do it for 30 or 40 years. And that is the point when I said, what do I really want to do? And I want to spend my time fishing. I love to be on the lakes and out in the woods and the waters and the creeks. And so how can I use this degree and spend my time in that environment? And that is really what pointed me in the direction. One thing led to another, including ending up here at a large aquarium on Lake Michigan.
It's funny you were an equine surgeon because you're not the first person on this podcast to have started off there and end up as an aquatic veterinarian. Dr. Don Apt from episode 4, Founding Aquavet, also shared a similar story. Has there been anything that has completely surprised you by the shift to turning to working more with aquatic animals, whether marine mammals or fish or others?
I think one of the things that really has surprised me, has followed me to where I am now, is the influence of the environment that the animal lives in. So in veterinary school, we were told that common things occur commonly.
Oh yeah, don't find the zebra, find the horse.
That's right. When you hear hoofbeats, don't expect a zebra. Now, if you're in a zoo, it may very well be a zebra. It may be an impala or a gnu or something like that, right? So it really depends on, you know, common things are environmentally dependent. So common things differ depending upon where you are. That really holds true for a lot of medicine. So in my career, I've been in a number of different facilities, everywhere from the West Coast to here on the Great Lakes, open ocean systems, about as wild type as you can get, all the way to aquarium-born animals that are housed in really highly managed systems. And what has become really apparent is that the common things in those different environments are very different. Even when I was on the West Coast, just across town, another facility, right? And the things that we saw were different than the things that they saw. So you really have to kind of understand what's common for your environment and think about that. And that's helped a lot.
Interesting. So what does that mean in your current context?
So currently, I work at an artificial built environment. An aquarium is defined as artificial. And so we have a responsibility of making sure that all of the aspects of the environment that we provide are optimal for the animals, right? And of course, as an aquarium, it's water, it's noise, right? There are certain animals that can detect acoustic energy way past their human hearing capacity, right? You know, marine mammals are big at biosonar, but they're not the only ones. And so there can be acoustic energy in the environment that is perceived by those animals and potentially be harassing the animals and air quality, light. Certain herps, reptiles, of course, need exposure to very specific wavelength of natural sunlight, which is very difficult to produce indoors. So you either have to have permissible windows that allow it to go through, which are very expensive, or artificial lights. You know, it's hard to replicate the sun, and you have to kind of keep up and watch those things. So it's the whole environment. And the built environment has an influence on the health of the residents. And that's something that's becoming very well recognized in human medicine. There's something called the hygiene hypothesis. In modern hygienic society, we don't suffer from a lot of the maladies that happen in less well-developed environments. So we don't get cholera and dysentery and these sorts of things on any kind of regular basis. So there's a lot of comforts that have been added by being hygienic and clean and sanitary. However, there's been some costs associated with it. We do see a much higher prevalence of things like allergies, asthma, autoimmune disorders, even some behavioral disorders. And there's a lot of scientific correlation between those things and changes in the microbiota that are associated with us. So we evolve alongside unseen living organisms in a partnership. And in artificial environments, you tend to have a much different immune response than you do in a wild type environment.
And is that something that we're just starting to recognize, or do you think that's something that veterinarians have been looking at for a while?
It's still relatively new, but this has been recognized for several decades now. Human medicine has discovered this quite a while ago. Veterinary medicine now talks a lot about the microbiome, right? And microbial assemblages. You can buy commercial products now that try to shape the microbiome by providing either prebiotics or probiotics. And that's all based on trying to shift the microbial communities that are associated with the patient, recognizing that those microbial communities are important. They're little living factories. They're metabolically active. They're producing molecules. And a lot of those molecules have biological activity. So why wouldn't they affect the biology of their host? And the more we look, the more we find out, yep, that's true for almost every living thing that's been explored so far.
So let's say we have 5 dolphins in one area in an aquarium. Would you say that each individual dolphin has its own microbiome, given that it's in the same system, it's eating the same foods? And let's say for this example, none of them are on medications.
So that's a great question. Yeah, with the technology we have now, if you look at longitudinal samples, right, multiple samples over a long period of time, you will be able to detect a signature, if you will, for each sample. So I will be able to tell you which individual animal it is, because they will have their own individual signature microbiome. And in fact, you can even determine sight on the animal. I could tell you the chuff of a dolphin or the exhalation of the animal has a very distinct microbiome compared to what's on the skin, compared to what's in the feces or in the gastric fluid. So you can get really, really highly refined if you look at enough data over a long enough period of time. In fact, in human medicine, there's even efforts to do this forensically. So they can detect the microbiome of someone who has entered a building or a facility and say, well, this person was here because this is a unique microbiome to that individual. So it's pretty powerful stuff.
That's really cool. A little creepy, but very cool.
Yeah, it is. And we're still continuing to learn stuff, right? So certain aspects of microbial communities are shared between different organisms. You can see there's a mammalian microbiome, there's an avian microbiome, right? And then within different species and in different individuals and different body sites. And so it's really incredible. And it's all about the microbes. You think about the microbe, you have to think in different scales. You can't see them, so you got to think in different size scales, right? Spatially. They're invisible to the naked eye. You also got to think in different time scales, because a lot of these organisms, even with sort of minimal essential requirements, can reproduce in several hours. For instance, E. coli under minimal essential media can double 8 times in 24 hours, right? So every 3 hours. So that means in 24 hours, right? It's like your great, 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 great grandmother was alive yesterday. So it's really weird. It's a whole different time scale as well as spatial scale. So we have to think differently when we think about microorganisms. And it's sometimes hard for us to do that.
I know you're working on a big study at SHED. So what is your goal with this study and by studying these microbiomes?
The goal is really to understand the things that are under our control as management choices and how that influences the microbes that are in the environment, and thus the health and welfare of the resident animals, right? So the biggest one is probably disinfection. Many of the animals that we house fall under regulations, right? The Animal Welfare Act says if you're going to keep dolphins and whales, you have to meet these standards. And the standards include things like the size of the enclosure, right? The cleanliness of the feeding program, the water quality, which includes what they call indicator organisms for cleanliness of the water. Right. So currently, that standard says that the water that the animals live in cannot exceed 1,000 total coliforms per 100 mils in a weekly period. Right. So if it exceeds that, you can check it again several times. But the idea is we want the water to be healthy and clean. Now, the challenge we have is that standard was originally created way back 1972. And it really is based upon human recreational water exposure standards, right? You go to the beach and sometimes you'll see the sign that says, oh, the beach is closed. And that's because there are indicator organisms that are monitored that reflect a risk to human health. They say, ooh, this water has enough a fecal contamination in it could be dangerous to a human's health. You might get a diarrhea or an infection. And that was chosen for these marine mammal standards because we didn't have any marine mammal standards. And so the question was, well, what should we use? And the folks that were consulted say, well, what do we use for people? We'll use human standard. You can't get any better than human standards. They said, oh, well, for human standards, we use coliform counts. That's what we're going to do. We will use human standards, just like we use human standards for their foodstuffs, right? We feed restaurant quality food. You can't get any better than that. So it was noble, but it's a little naive because marine mammals are not people. And they evolved for 60 million years in an aquatic environment that is a soup of all kinds of microbes. And so that has created some challenges for us. It's an easy standard to meet, too. We just throw all kinds of oxidants at the water, UV sterilization, or these sorts of things. And and you don't have those coliforms. You can't count them. You can't find them. The fascinating thing is when you look at what goes on to the community of organisms in the water, it's incredibly different than what you would find sort of in a wild type community. And that we understand is important for the health of the animals. There's plenty of studies out there now. If you look at mice, for instance, that are used as a biomedical model, and these are lab mice, they evolve and grow and thrive in a laboratory environment. They've never been a wild animal. And if you look at their immune capacity or immune function, and compare that to a wild type mouse, completely different. And I believe we see similar things in animals under human care. Certainly marine mammals in highly managed systems, but it's also true for fishes and lots of other animals. And there is more and more research into this area that supports that.
Interesting. I'm curious, going back a little bit, you said that the total coliform count was based in 1972. Are there many regulations that you use in managed care facilities that are based, I'm assuming, off of the Marine Mammal Protection Act?
Yeah, so the Marine Mammal Protection Act was passed in 72, I believe, right? And that is when the USDA was tapped to provide responsibility for marine mammals under human care.
Oh, interesting.
So the Animal Welfare Act included marine mammals now. So USDA's primary responsibility is not marine mammals, right? They are protecting the nation's agriculture and production facilities and that sort of thing. But now they've inherited marine mammals. And so it's not really one of their core business areas, if you will. So it's a little bit of a challenge, like, well, what standards do we use? And I think, again, that's where some of this challenge has happened. There's a need really to update this. And, you know, meanwhile, those of us that take care of the animals, we all share the goal of doing a better job. And so we're trying to understand better ways. So we can live within the standards. We just want to do it differently than we used to, right? So a lot of people used to think that, well, zeros are great numbers for coliform counts. I think you'll find that that's different today. I would get concerns if I saw zeros constantly because I'm wondering, are we over-oxidizing the water, right? We know now that there are things like disinfection byproducts that are potentially hazardous, and we want to minimize those, right? So we're trying to get smarter about how we treat water.
So has that been one of the main things you've seen so far, changes in the way that you use disinfectants?
Yeah, that is one of the things we've changed. We also do things different, like move water from fish systems into our marine mammal system. And there's a number of advantages to that. We used to, when we backwash filters for fish systems, the water, the backwash just go to drain, right? And we would just lose that. We currently will move water from a lot of our fish systems that is aged or a water change is due in the fish system. Instead of throwing it to drain, we can put it into a marine mammal system. Because those animals are not breathing the water. They're just swimming in it and floating in it and existing in it. They're not breathing it. So marine mammals are much more tolerant of certain water quality parameters than fishes are. So you can get an ammonia level that would be fatal to fish, and a marine mammal, it wouldn't bother that much, right? So we have a lot of latitude there. And in the process of moving aged water from fish systems to the marine mammal systems, we're also moving a lot of microbes and nutrients. And what we've seen in our systems is that has changed the microbial community structure of the water that the marine mammals are in. And we believe in a positive direction that's supported by, you know, looking at the microbial signatures of the organisms. So it's been just another way that we do things differently than we used to.
And then have you seen a positive change reflected in the microbial communities within the individual animals themselves?
Well, that's interesting. So the animal signature tends to be very different than the water. And that's shown in both free-ranging animals and animals in managed care. If you look at the surface and or fecal or respiratory microbiota associated with the animal, they're very different than what you find in the water. And so people will talk about a core microbiome. And so the core microbiome of the individual patient doesn't necessarily reflect the microbiome of the environment or the water. Now, it's influenced by it. And this is an area we're really trying to understand better, because we know that we can change the characteristic of the microbiota associated with the patient using things like antibiotics or probiotics, right? Or changing diet. That will change the microbes that are associated with the patient. We also know that we can change the microbes associated with the environment. And in the case of aquatic animals, the water, right? We can do that by oxidizing the water. We can do it by changing nutrients in the water. We could change the temperature of the water. We could cycle the temperature of the water. We can change the salinity of water. All those things will change the microbes that are associated with that water. What we really want to know is which of those two scenarios has the most influence on the health of the patient, right? What we want to know is, how do we optimize conditions for the health of the patient, encourage them to have a robust, fit, healthy immune system? And that's what's really fascinating, because there is strong evidence that the environment, the microbes in the environment, influence the immune system of the resident animals. But very often, the environment also distinctly different from the animals, right? So we tend to focus on, oh, we're going to use probiotics, we're going to use all these different things to affect the microbial communities of the animal, when actually what we might want to do is impact the microbial communities of the environment. And that's something we're really trying to understand better. But I believe that the environment and the microbes that are in the environment have a profound effect on the immune capacity of the resident animals when we're talking about aquatic animals, and that we really want to manage those microbial communities just as much as the ones on the animals themselves. So that's where we're trying to go with this. Like, what should we do to encourage a robust, healthy microbial community in the environment that the animals are living in, because it does affect them?
That's fascinating. And I'm curious though, because you keep saying, you know, robust, healthy environment, how do you determine what healthy means?
Right. Great question, right? And it is a challenge. So some of my colleagues have spent hours and hours or weeks together trying to define what is a healthy animal. And it's not easy. You'd think it'd be simple, but it's not, because there's different measures, right? But in general, we're talking about freedom from disease, and their welfare is looked after. They're not in any kind of distress, right? So that's what we want, right? We want physically fit, emotionally fit, and free from disturbance of their homeostasis, right? And so it's all about balance. You know, we're all infected. So being infected doesn't mean having a disease. You are colonized by things right now that, given the right conditions, could be fatal. And we see this all the time, right? We disturb that balance and we see that the consequence is a disease. So it's about understanding balance and how to keep a system balanced. And it's true not only for bacteria and viruses and fungus and things, but even some metazoan and protozoan parasites, right? Common parasites that are seen, most animals that come from the wild have a low burden and they're coexisting with it. It's only when conditions get right that you tip the balance in favor of the protozoan, when now it becomes a disease-causing organism, and we tend to call it a parasite. We got to rethink about what we mean with some of these host-microbe relationships. And that's another thing that's incredibly scientifically fascinating, is I told you that the microbes associated with the individual animals tend to be very different than those in the environment. How does the host enable that to happen? How does the host say, okay, this particular organism is allowed to colonize and thrive and grow in or on me, and the exclusion of others? And there's some fascinating examples. Think about something like bioluminescent organisms, right? Little bobtail squid. That's a Vibrio fischeri. It's a very specific bacteria that, when those organisms are hatched from an egg, they're exposed to this incredible soup of things. And in that location on the organism's body, it says, okay, you can come in here and thrive and grow, but nobody else. How does it do that? So if, you know, if we could understand those host microbe relationships, we could probably look for things that would be useful for us in managing them on a bigger scale or in healthcare, right?
These are some really big questions that you and your team are studying.
Yeah, well, there's never a lack of another question, right? Every time we answer one, we get another one that we're trying to figure out. The other thing I guess I'll mention is we started investigating this, looking at some very specific questions about the environment and understanding the environment better, particularly as it applies to the microbial communities that are there. But what we're finding out now is the tools that we use to understand what microbes are there. So these molecular tools, right, sequencing, are helping us clinically in more situations than we expected. So we're getting presented with these quick clinical questions like, hey, I have a system, something went on, we lost a bunch of animals, the chemistries are all normal, we don't know what's going on, is this a metal, is it a toxin? And when we look at the microbial communities in those systems, very often they're very different from baseline. So something, of course, bloomed. And sometimes those blooms are organisms that are very poorly understood. What are they doing? And remember, I said that all these little things are molecular factories, right? They're little metabolic factories. They're doing stuff. So they're consuming nutrients or they're creating byproducts. And sometimes that is important for the health of the animals that live in the systems. Some of these are pretty well recognized, right? Like cyanobacteria produce certain toxins, right? Microcystins, it's all pretty well worked out. But guess what? There's thousands of these little things out there that have probably never even been described yet. And we scratch our head, well, what happened here? But as we use these tools, we're starting to get more and more clues to what happens sometimes in those clinical situations.
It's so cool. I could talk to you about this for so long. I feel like this is something you touch the surface of in vet school, but the actual implications clinically, we don't really discuss ever, which is very cool.
Yeah, it's still a new technology, right? The instruments that are used are the same instruments that were used to sequence the human genome, right? In the Human Genome Project, which was a 10-year project and cost about $3 billion, right? Today, right, the technology has advanced so far that we get the same kind of information in much shorter time frames, right? On the order of weeks or days for much less money, right? Hundreds to thousands of dollars instead of millions to billions. So
it's super cool. So I heard a rumor that you were one of the very few people who's worked on an orthopedic case with an aquatic minded, like amphibian type species.
Yeah.
And the reason this is important is that my father is an orthopedic surgeon.
Oh, okay.
Human orthopedic surgeon. And in, I think I've published now 65 episodes, something like that.
Yeah.
He's never had a shout out because I haven't found somebody to talk about an orthopedic case.
All right.
So I have to hear the story.
I can tell you the story. It is a favorite story of mine for many reasons. Story goes, you know, anytime we get new animals into the collection, we generally run them through a quarantine period for many reasons, infectious disease control, as well as just acclimating the animals to this environment, right? Letting them get used to the noise and the motions and the temperatures and the people and the foods and all that stuff. And several years ago, we had a special exhibit on amphibians, and one of our aquarists brought in from his grandmother's pond, three American bullfrogs, which are common in this area, but they're really cool amphibians. And they were in quarantine. We had two males and a female in quarantine. And one day the quarantine manager brought one of the males up and said, can you check? I think there's something going on with his leg. And I said, well, how do we know? And he picked the frog up and the leg was kind of dangling out to the side. I was like, oh, he's clearly hurt his leg. And I remembered an obscure injury described in veterinary school called the unhappy triad of O'Donohue. And it is a common skier's injury for people in downhill skiing. So it's three structures are injured, the medial collateral ligament, the anterior cruciate ligament, and the medial meniscus. So those three are torn, disrupted, and so the leg flops out laterally to the side, just kind of dangles out to the side. And I saw the frog. I said, well, this guy's got the unhappy triad of O'Donohue. What the heck are we going to do? If it's a dog or a person with a similar knee injury, you would do an orthopedic procedure and put in some prosthetic ligaments and stabilize the knee And so that's what we did. We took him to surgery and anesthetized him and put a suture that stabilized the knee. And the animal did phenomenal. He healed up just great. He lived here for many years. And you wouldn't even have known he had this injury had you not, you know, pick him up and look for his scar. You could see the scar on the knee, just like, you know, a human that had gone through knee surgery. And at the time, one of my colleagues was a guest editor for a journal and said, would you write this up? I said, oh, sure, I'll write this up. And that's really where the cool part is. There's so many layers to this. Number one, I don't even know if a frog has a cruciate ligament, right? If you think about it, how do we know? And if you go look at the scientific literature, I went all the way back to a late 19th century publication out of Germany, which was the definitive treatise on the anatomy of the American bullfrog. And it doesn't say anything about the internal knee anatomy. People just don't think about it, in spite of how often frogs are used in biology classes and studied. So we don't even know. Secondly, when we tried to anesthetize this animal, we had a resident, our first resident. So we're a teaching hospital, and the first resident in that program, who now happens to be the senior veterinarian at a major aquarium in the Midwest, she says, oh, I read this paper where we can anesthetize frogs by taking some halothane and mixing it with a little jelly, sterile lube, and putting on a cotton ball and stick it on the back of the frog, and they'll just go to sleep. I said, great. Let's give it a try. So she got all set up, put the cotton ball on the frog. And I came back about 5 minutes later. The frog was still wide awake. And she's like, well, let's see. I don't know. So she tried another dose. And then I said, well, let me know when it's ready. And I came back about 10 minutes later. The frog was still awake. And she now had it in a bag and was trying to bubble isoflurane into it. And finally, she got this frog anesthetized using MS-222, which is what we use for fishes. But in fishes, typically we would start with a dose somewhere maybe around 100 parts per million for a typical teleost. I mean, there's variation. But for amphibians, and particularly this frog, oftentimes you have to use much higher. So we had to use like 600 parts per million or higher. So the question is, we know that amphibians are in trouble in many places in the world. And one of the reasons is that they're prone to a lot of contaminants and chemicals in the environment, and they're very sensitive, right? Chlorine in the water can be a problem for display amphibians. So why would an animal so sensitive to so many chemicals require 6 to 8 times the dose of this chemical? And again, really, nobody really knows for sure, right? So there's so many fascinating things. And then, of course, the bottom line is, doesn't matter what the animal is here, we'll take care of it. I mean, it could be a frog or anything. We're going to provide it the same care and give it that individual patient care. So one day I was up walking through the galleries in the public space, and I saw a family looking at the frog. And I said, oh, let me tell you about this frog. Turned out they were from Germany, and grandpa was with them, and grandpa didn't know much English. And so the daughter was interpreting, and he was kind of standing off in the back and seemed kind of disengaged. But I told the story, and then I said the unhappy triad of O'Donoghue. All of a sudden he lit up and he says, I know Dr. O'Donoghue. He met Dr. O'Donoghue. So it was he had this connection to the whole story and the frog. And, those are the kinds of things you could never predict and prepare for as a veterinarian or in an aquarium, but they happen all the time. So, yeah. And that publication is out there. You can look it up if you want. It's got pictures of the frog with the cotton ball on his back.
No, that's an amazing story. And thank you. Thank you for sharing an orthopedic story to my father and the entire OR team who listens every single week during surgery in the OR.
Excellent.
That story's for you.
Perfect.
Dr. Van Bon, it has been an absolute pleasure talking with you today. Thank you for telling us about your research in the microbiome and sharing that fantastic orthopedic story about the bullfrog. Thank you so much for being here on Aquadocs.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
And that's going to do it for this week's episode of Aquadocs. I'd like to thank Dr. Van Bon for being on the show this week, our sponsors WAVMA and AAFE, as well as all of you, our wonderful listeners, for tuning in. As always, check out our Facebook and Instagram to stay up to date on the latest Aquadocs news. And if you've got an extra moment, please rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. I'm Michelle Greenfield. Stay healthy, stay safe, and we'll see you next time here on Aquadocs.